Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 134, recorded October 21, 2011. Siri, Sony, Sunny. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Ford, featuring Wi-Fi connectivity with available Sync and MyFord Touch. Now your car can be a Wi-Fi hotspot. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Vast Conference, the ultimate in professionalism, clarity, and flexibility for your conference calls, all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to VastConference.com and use promo code TWiL. And by Carbonite Business, online backup for your law office. Carbonite Business backs up your computer files automatically and continually and keeps them safely off-site. Try it free at Carbonite.com and get two bonus months with offer code TWiL. Hey everyone, it's Denise Howell here, and you've joined us for our fifth anniversary episode of This Week in Law. We think there may be some wood involved. I definitely came prepared for our wooden anniversary. And if anybody has any vampire steaks they want to send our way due to the festive season that we're in, feel free. All of that would be appropriate given the occasion. We do have one of our original TWiL cast members with us today, and that's Ernie Svensson. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, Denise, how you doing? It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Thank you so much for coming to celebrate our big fifth year anniversary.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't miss it.
It's great to have you. Also joining us is someone who is just so integral to our show. Well, we're showing Eric Goldman right now, also very integral to our show, one of our favorite guests, and definitely the law professor with the mostest. Eric Goldman is back with us. Hi, Eric.
Hi, happy anniversary. Congratulations on 5 years of doing great work.
Thank you so much. It's great to have you back. And of course, last but far from least is Evan Brown, who is here with us in the trenches just about every week. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Happy 5 years. It's awesome to be here just about every week. So glad we can do it again this week as well.
Yes, me too. It's wonderful to have you back. And I'm noticing that you're wearing a very attractive t-shirt there. That's really nice. You want to tell us what that represents?
Well, sure. I dress like this every day here at an Am Law 200 law firm that I work in. This is just how we roll, you know, lawyers.
Exactly.
I am wearing this to be a good sport. If you'll remember, way back in April of 2010, Ernie was on the show with us, and we were talking about that whole iPhone 4 incident, the iPhone 4, not the 4S, you know, when the guy lost it at the bar and they were investigating it. And, you know, it was when Gizmodo wrote about it. And we were talking about whether Apple was going to go after the people, or whether there was going to be a lawsuit filed, or whether there was going to be any charges, whether there were going to be charges pressed. And I said, We went back and reviewed this, and I think there may be a clip. And so I made a bet with Ernie saying that if there was going to be action taken within a certain period of time, I would wear a New Orleans Saints shirt on the show. So here I am, the way things have transpired. Maybe or maybe I'm not obligated to do it, but I'm here just to kind of be playing along with Ernie, and also to celebrate the fact that the Colts and the Saints are playing this weekend. And, you know, I'm from Indiana. I was born and raised there, and the Indianapolis Colts are not doing all that well this year. So it's going to be fun to watch the Colts play the Saints this weekend, and to have the Colts have their first win of the season coming up. So that's why I'm decked out in New Orleans Saints shirt here today.
Yes, as lawyers are wont to do, I think it might be a good idea to go into the specific terms of this arrangement. And I think we have the actual clip queued up. Let's go ahead and roll it. And I'll make that three. Evan, any final bits of wisdom?
If there is an arrest or a civil complaint filed between now and 2 weeks from today concerning the, we'll just call it the, that iPhone, I will wear a New Orleans Saints jersey on the show.
Wow.
You heard it here.
Well, I'm not going to say that you're wrong.
So there we go. The actual terms were an arrest or civil complaint sometime between May 20th, 2010 and June 10th, 2010. In fact, though, Brian Hogan and Sage Wallflower, the two people who wound up being charged about the iPhone 4 theft, weren't actually charged until August 10th, 2011. So, Evan, I think you're definitively off the hook, but you're kindly conceding a T-shirt in lieu of the actual jersey that you promised to wear. So that's wonderful of you.
Two weeks, you know, 16 months, not much of a difference. You know, the original term were 2 weeks and they waited 16 months and that's fine. So it's all good.
Right. Just to remind people who these folks were, Brian Hogan was the person who allegedly found the iPhone 4 in the bar. And then Sage Wallflower allegedly made the calls to sites like Gizmodo. Gizmodo paid them $4,750. For the iPhone 4 prototype, which they then wrote about and showed, et cetera. Gizmodo was never charged, although the DA in Santa Clara County, I believe, sat on that, or San Mateo County, sat on that information for a long time before deciding who they were going to charge. Hogan and Wallflower recently pled no contest to the charges. They were sentenced to probation, 40 hours of community service, and $250 each as restitution to Apple. I would venture to say Apple doesn't really find that to be adequate restitution. And they were, you know, sort of insult to injury, allowed to keep that $4,750 that they got from the sale of the phone to Gizmodo. But I think we can finally say this whole incident, which started in early 2010, has come to a rest with them. Pleading no contest. Eric, this is close to your neck of the woods. I'm sure that everyone there is assured and sleeps safer at night knowing that these two have met with justice.
I would feel a lot more comfortable with the prosecutions if Apple hadn't screwed up again. So at some point you start to wonder if Apple is really a victim or just is sloppy.
Yeah, EFF is not happy with the prosecutors, actually, who I guess made some snarky comments about Gizmodo and the correspondence that they seized from, Jason Chen's computer. Mm-hmm. They jumped in and without any reason to really comment on it, called those exchanges juvenile. And there was really no need for that, and EFF sort of slapped them on the wrist and said, you know what, there was no need to go in and seize a journalist's private files and rifle through them in the way you did. So it was an interesting incident, but it has finally come to a close. Ernie, do you feel vindicated?
I wasn't really looking for vindication or to force Evan to wear clothing that represented the team he doesn't support. I'm not in favor of that, but I admire his goodwill and gamesmanship. So that's a tribute. Maybe if Siri had been around back then, we could have, you know, called upon Siri to resolve this question.
That's right. That's right, indeed. I'm still, I'm hearing Siri call to me. I would really love to upgrade, but I checked with AT&T, and because I used their discounted upgrade the last time I purchased an iPhone, I'm not eligible again until 2013. So Siri's going to have to call loudly and maybe make me a loan before I go ahead and integrate her into my life. One thing that has happened recently that is super interesting, and again, the resolution of something that's been pending for some time. It's not a resolution, but it is a big event toward the resolution of the Viacom versus YouTube $1 billion damages litigation, is that the Second Circuit held oral argument in the case. And there's a lot of analysis and discussion about that. And it seems to be mostly turning on the extent of YouTube's knowledge and whether they acted appropriately given the knowledge that they had. Eric, are you nervous that this case is going to get overturned and the safe harbor that It was Judge, let me get his name right, Lewis Stanton in New York from the district court there, found applied to YouTube. Are you worried that's going to get taken away?
I thought that the judge wrote a very, reached the right result, but I think that the opinion cut some corners analytically, and it left open the possibility that the Second Circuit will find some of those gaps significantly deficient enough to make the judge try again. So I think a lot of it depends on how the judges evaluate the lower opinion and think that the gaps need to be cured, if at all. I'm hoping that the Second Circuit will reach the same conclusion as the judge at the district court. I think the district court got it spot on. I also think that it's quite confusing that this case continues to drag on. I just don't understand what Viacom is looking for, and they are spending a lot of everyone's money to try and get whatever they're seeking.
Well, let's see. It was Paul Smith, Viacom's lawyer, who was asked to tell the court on oral argument just exactly what they're looking for. They did discuss damages a bit, and no one was able to quantify those in the oral argument. But he told the court that he had a big ask and a small ask. The big ask involved an interpretation of the DMCA saying that ISPs like YouTube have an affirmative obligation to make sure their systems are clean before being eligible for the safe harbor. Then he asked for the small ask, which meant that the case could be remanded to the district court for more fact-finding, and you know, we might wind up with another decision that then went up on appeal again, so it would drag on even longer in that case. Evan, what do you think about the oral argument here?
It was that was an interesting tactic that Paul Smith had there, and you know, making this big request, you know, which was kind of asking for the moon and the stars, and then you know, make that, what that does tactically is make the more realistic request, you know, going back and doing a little bit more fact finding in what is clearly a very fact intensive case, very complicated, of course. It makes that look much more reasonable. It's kind of like, you know, you're setting the judges up to actually make a good decision on what it actually does. So I thought that was an interesting tactic, and it makes a lot of sense, because given the fact that the way the service has evolved over time, the public perception of YouTube and the practical aspects of it are much different now in 2011 than what they were in 2005. So there's been a longer period of time for it to become more normalized, if you will, for people to be more used to it and to be more used to how it actually works. And the dramatic nature of what may have been some infringement going on, direct infringement, seeding the service with some infringing materials at the beginning. The more we get away from that, the less bad that becomes. And so if we're going to go back and just focus on those things, it seems like something much more likely for the court to actually do. So interesting tactic, and it very well may work. Who knows? We'll just see what the judges say.
Eric, it seems from the coverage of the oral argument I've read, I would have loved to attend. It was in New York, so difficult for us to do that. But it really looks like it must have been fascinating. And it seems like Google really stuck to its guns on noticed being the only efficient way and the only legal obligation they have under the DMCA to be able to determine that infringing materials on the site. And Google, I don't know how much it came up in argument. You know, obviously they do way more policing now with their video identification system. But they contend that they're not obligated to do that. They're just going above and beyond. And Viacom's lawyers kept saying, you know, it's just not enough. Notice is not enough. If you go and you, for example, in his closing statement, the lawyer for the plaintiff class argued you can go in and type "Let's Fall in Love" and YouTube will give you up to 50 recordings of that song, which Viacom owns. They obviously have the means to find it in order to serve it up to you. How do you think the court's going to deal with this notice is sufficient argument?
The statute has two different ways that a service provider can have notice. First, they can have, quote, actual knowledge. And one way of reading the statute is the only way for a service provider to have actual knowledge is through a takedown notice. The other is that there's what's called the red flags of infringement, that infringement would be obvious on its face if anyone chose to look at it. And so the idea is the service provider is looking at their website and they look at something and say, oh my God, that must be infringing. And at that point, they can't simply turn tail and ignore it. I've taken the position that there is no such thing as red flags of infringement anymore because of this case. We saw that Viacom was seeding YouTube's database with clips that it was posting itself, in some cases trying to mask the origin of them. And when they brought the complaint twice, they were unable to figure out what they actually had posted themselves versus somebody else posting. So I don't think there is such a thing as red flags of infringement anymore. If that's the case, then the only thing that's left is actual knowledge. And I read the statute say takedown notices are the only way to get there. So I actually think YouTube's position is a good one. However, if that were the only thing YouTube were arguing, I think that that would ring hollow on judges. They would say, you're seriously saying you'd have to do nothing and sit on the sidelines, just wait for the notices to occur. But YouTube does so much more than that. I think that the combination of YouTube's argument plus their actual practices could very well be sellable.
Right. Do you have any idea, you know, having not combed through the entire appellate record on this case, whether YouTube's affirmative steps that it's taken since this case was filed in 2007, are they part of the record or are they outside it?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but in the summary judgment motion that Viacom filed, it put in footnote number one saying everything after May 2008, we think is fine. YouTube deployed adequate filters at that point. We're not complaining about any behavior since then. So I don't know what that does to the record because Viacom would be able to say whatever they did after that is irrelevant because we've already stipulated that we're fine with their behavior then.
Mm-hmm. Ernie, what is your gut reaction to all of this?
My gut reaction is that whatever Eric said sounds pretty good to me.
Whatever Eric says always sounds great to me, yes.
Yeah, it always sounds great, and it sounds especially good when I hear it live.
Exactly. Evan, you were going to jump in.
Well, I just thought that was interesting. Of course, I agree with everything Eric says as well. He's the smartest guy out there when it comes to this stuff. But one thing that that did pique my interest in what you said was that the red flags standard really shouldn't apply. And I thought we got a pretty good example of the red flags analysis in the ISO Hunt case. I think it was called Fung, right? One of the parties in that, where at least the lower court, and I think it's still pending before the Ninth Circuit. I don't know if there's been a decision. I know the oral arguments were in the spring on the ISO Hunt case. This is one, you know, those BitTorrent tracker sites where you can go to download torrents and to find torrents to download. There were some really good indicia of what would be a red flag in that situation. Like, for example, labeling certain categories, you know, top 25 most popular films, something like that would just be so obviously beat you over the head infringing. I'm just, I'd be curious to hear a little bit more why you think that the red flags argument would be dead when it's not hard to find real examples and even easier to imagine situations where infringement would just be really obvious to the site owner.
So Denise, do I get to go tete-a-tete with Evan here, or is that
yes, absolutely? Jump in.
I hear you, Evan, but I think there are two different issues. First, there's the issue of metadata that the site provides, things like top lists or navigational structures. We're going to divide all of the videos into the comedy versus the drama versus the how-to videos. And I think trying to assume red flags of infringement based on setting up metadata both discourages service providers from putting metadata in place and is really at best a proxy for the underlying quality or character of the video. It's, you know, at YouTube, plenty of the videos that are most popular are all the viral videos that have no tie to one of the commercialized copyrighted clips. So I think the metadata argument doesn't work, but I definitely would point out the problem with copyright owners posting works themselves, that Viacom was doing that freely and still is doing that. And corporate owners are desperate for using their own content as marketing for other stuff that they're selling, whether it's clips of content for full versions or it's merchandise or whatever. The corporate owners are desperately clamoring for attention in the marketplace. And so it has become impossible to tell if a clip is posted because someone ripped it off or if it's because this is part of an astroturfing campaign or if this is part of a guerrilla campaign on the part of the marketing team of the content owner to get more attention for their works. So that's why I take the position. I think in 1998, it was pretty easy to tell red flags infringement. If there was a commercial copyrighted work in the marketplace and it was online, chances are it was ripped off. I just don't think that's true anymore in 2011.
Yeah,
I guess those are all good points, but it just I'm surprised to hear you declare kind of like a per se rule, because based on what we were saying there, it seems like it would be pretty specific to the site. And I don't know, maybe if you're trying to make some distinction between the metadata being an indicator of that to somehow make it so that it's not a red flag of infringement because it doesn't arise from the content itself versus that being just a red flag in general, regardless of its origin. So those are all good points. It just seems I'm always, cautious to think of things in terms of per se rules like that, I guess, is what my concern is.
The problem is that Congress tried to have it both ways. They tried to basically say, we have a scienter level of actual knowledge. We all understand that from first-year law school. And then they tried to create this red flags of infringement, which I would characterize as trying to be something between recklessness and negligence. The scienter levels are a spectrum, not a series of nodes. But they tried to squeeze in this other concept that doesn't really have a clear a point on the spectrum. And so I don't think they should have even done that. But having done that, I think that the rules have just changed in the last 13 years, that so many more content owners are spiking the databases with their own content in ways that would have never occurred in 1998. So I agree with you. I normally wouldn't want to kibosh a rule and say that it's just dropped out of the statute. But I think that the practices have changed so dramatically that that's the only conclusion I can reach.
Hey, Denise, can I talk about the honey badger? Don't care about red flags of infringement?
Absolutely.
And this is taking this in a little different direction, but it's funny. You know, when I first started looking at things on YouTube, everybody talked about, is this something that's somebody created personally, or is it something that's copyright protected? And I'm sure everybody's seen the honey badger video. If you haven't, just Google honey badger and you'll see it. And it went totally viral, and it's this video, I don't know who took it originally, Animal Planet or something, and some guy put his own narrative to it, which is just really incredibly funny. And it went completely viral. That LSU football players now have nicknames the honey badger. And the other day on TV, I saw, I think it was an insurance company, using the honey badger video
narrated
by this guy. Oh, pistachios, that's it, right, exactly. So, and I'm sure that was all licensed, and the guy got paid, but it's just an example of, this guy took that video. Now, did he have permission to do that initially? I don't know. Maybe not. But now he's totally mainstream. I'm sure he's getting paid because people liked that video. And if people can figure out how to make money off of something, then I'm sure that the initial concern about who had the copyright and who didn't kind of evaporates. But obviously not every video is as exciting and interesting and lucrative as the Honey Badger video. So anyway, that's...
But I tell you, what's really going to make money is the people who have figured out that you can draw Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle heads on celebrities' noses in photographs. That's really what's going to capitalize. That's really what's going to be the cash cow. And I don't know if you've run across those things, but you need to check that out.
Well, I'm sure that Animal Planet probably did jump in at some point when this began to be commercial. I haven't researched this at all, but... it seems like it would be something that would be problematic for him before it all became a business model. What do you think, Eric?
I'm sorry, I got distracted here.
Honey badgers would do that to you.
I must say, I had not seen the honey badgers video, so I'm scrambling, trying to catch up.
Eating snakes—it's disgusting.
All right. Well, now that we've devolved down that honey badger hole, I did think, Eric, in light of what you said a minute ago, it was interesting that the lawyer did toss in YouTube's current conduct as something to the court's consideration of this appeal when they went in and said, hey, you should go back to your chambers and look for Let's Fall in Love and see what you find, because they've stipulated that everything after 2008 is okay. That sounds like dirty pool to me, doesn't it to you?
I think that's a leading question there, counselor. You know, look, all's fair in love and litigation. But I come back to the point, what does Viacom want? Does Viacom want YouTube to do something different today? Does Viacom want YouTube to do something different 6 years ago? Does Viacom just want a big check? I don't get it. And so, trying to get the judges to take a look at YouTube circa today when they're not complaining about YouTube today, I think further reinforces my puzzlement about what they want and why they're trying to, what the point of their litigation is.
Okay, well, we've got lots more to talk about today. We're going to time travel back to the Roman Empire and think about copyright considerations affecting that. We're going to talk more about privacy and what Amazon's been up to lately. But before we do that, I want to welcome back as a sponsor to the show, Ford. We love all the technology that Ford is putting in their cars. And one of the latest technologies from Ford's sync with My Ford Touch is Wi-Fi. I can't tell you how excited I am to hear this. I've actually been waiting for Wi-Fi to be available in a vehicle. And now I have a good selling point for why I need to trade my car in and go for a Ford. This feature can turn your car into a Wi-Fi hotspot, giving you and your passengers internet access for up to 5 devices at once. And if you've ever had folks in your car wanting to use an iPad, wanting to not have to use a cellular network for connectivity, this is just an incredible bonus. Here's how it works. You establish an internet connection to the Wi-Fi hotspot by plugging in a portable wireless access card from one of the wireless carriers into a USB port located in the center armrest console or the glove compartment or under the radio, depending on the model. Or if you have a BlackBerry, you can connect to the hotspot wirelessly via Bluetooth. Next, you connect up to 5 Wi-Fi enabled devices to the hotspot using a secure password, and you're in. Now you and your passengers can access music, browse the internet, download apps, or play games via Wi-Fi. They can connect their laptops, tablet, mobile phones, or other internet devices to the hotspot, up to 5 devices at once, all without an additional subscription or expense. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch featuring Wi-Fi connectivity is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. So thank you so much, Ford, for your support of This Week in Law. Let's go back to the Roman Empire for a moment and talk about that for a minute. There was a guy named James Irwin who was using Reddit, and he posted a series of stories there called Rome Sweet Rome. And they became quite popular and got a bit of buzz. And Warner Brothers came along. And I'm sure James Irwin was thrilled to hear from them because they wanted to buy the rights to make a movie out of his story, which I think is now its working title is When in Rome. And Eric Gardner, our good friend over at The Hollywood Reporter, who's been on the show many times, thought this was interesting because he went and looked at the Reddit terms of service, which include, of course, as do so many social sharing sites, the provision that James granted Reddit a non-exclusive worldwide sub-licensable license to anything that he might post there. So this, we've discussed this before on the show, and this is a nice concrete example of how artists who would like to be able to grant an exclusive license to their works, as I'm sure Warner Brothers would like to have and thinks it has, if you go and you read Eric's report on this, may actually have problems because they have licensed their work in a very broad and general way to the social site where they posted it. So Eric actually talked to Reddit's lawyers who found this issue interesting and intriguing and went ahead and conceded, yeah, we probably have some rights in that submission. And Warner Brothers, of course, thinks otherwise and said, basically, don't worry about it. We've got the exclusive rights. So I just think there's a conflict there, and it highlights this really large issue of the overbroad terms that are present in a lot of the social sharing sites and the larger issue of the enforcing contracts that people don't really read and how that happens all the time in various contexts online. So Eric, did you take a look at this, and do you think Warner Brothers is right that they have the exclusive rights in this?
I have no opinion about the rights issue. I haven't been able to trace all the different rights. I think the more interesting question is, how can Warner Brother best take over a community developed property and then take control over the community and try and steer its conversation? And you know, it makes a ton of sense to buy a property that comes from the community itself, that it becomes a community activity, because you already have a built-in audience. You already have crowdsourced the idea. You've had a bunch of bright thinkers all chiming in, and then you have a whole built-in audience interested in it. And then what I thought was really odd was Warner Brothers trying to take over that community and control its discussion. That, to me, seems like a very illogical step. You're disenfranchising the most core audience that's already built up.
I'm really worried about business models that are based on these overbroad user-generated content licenses that folks just don't read and they don't realize. There have been a lot of people who've abandoned TwitPic because it has this partnership with Wen that enables it to sell the people's TwitPic photos to Wen without any compensation to the folks who posted the photos there themselves. And I can envision all kinds of lucrative and streamlined and legal, based on these terms, and perfectly evil business models where you wouldn't have to have an exclusive partner like Wen and TwitPic. You could just sort of offer a smorgasbord, you know, whenever there's an interest in some bit of user-submitted content, someone could come in and make a bid, and the site could say, sure, go ahead. We have the rights to that, and we can sell it to you. Ernie, are you worried about this too?
Well, I'm worried. I guess I would be worried about it if I understood better what it is that the sites are trying to achieve by these very broad license grants. And I guess, I mean, when I think about it, it seems to me the legitimate reason, and I'm speculating, but the legitimate reason might be, well, you don't want to get sued for using content in a certain way that's not really burdensome to the user, in your opinion, as the site owner. So you try to craft something as broadly as possible to immunize yourself from that potential litigation. Then later on, maybe you come up with a business model and you say, oh, well, great, we've already got these very broad non-exclusive rights, let's make money off of it. But then that rubs up against something else that happens, and now you've got a conflict. And I mean, you know, I don't really know what they're trying to achieve, and it might be something specific, or it might just be trying to avoid litigation. I really don't know, but it's obviously causing problems. And I don't really know how it would ever get fixed, because trying to keep those sites from crafting very broad user agreements that they know people aren't going to really read doesn't seem like a practical reality.
So the story that Mr. Irwin wrote was about time-traveling Marines who go back to battle the soldiers of the Roman Empire. And I'm sure there are lots of folks in the online community who would like to send those time-traveling Marines after Sony, who purported to force users into binding individual arbitration and waiver of their class action rights with the fine print in one of their mandatory system updates for the PS3 recently. The only way to opt out of this was to send a written, as in on paper, letter by mail to Sony within 30 days of the update taking place. Now, you can imagine that probably not too many people caught that and did it. Evan, do you think this kind of agreement is actually enforceable?
I don't see why it's not enforceable. You know, there's plenty of grist for the mill of discussion about the proper formation and enforceability of online contracts, and whether they be click wrap agreements or browser app agreements. I know that Professor Goldman has written about that fairly recently, just this week, or at least there's been some content on his blog about that. I think Venkat wrote about one of those cases. So, you know, setting aside the question of the mechanics, you know, let's assume that the users actually had the opportunity to read these terms so that it meets the scrutiny under the Second Circuit's standard in the SPECT versus Netscape case, you know, so they could actually see it, and suppose they, you know, that everything was what do we call it, non-leaky, you know, so that actually the mechanics of the web architecture, the platform, made it so that they did assent to these terms, and that assent is demonstrated. Setting that aside, I don't see why this would be unenforceable. There's a question of whether it would be unconscionable. You know, the parties, the consumers, the end users are not being denied a remedy at all. They're just being denied a certain form of seeking that remedy. And it really, technically, actually in reality, they're not being denied that at all, because they have to, if they want to avail themselves of the opportunity to engage, or, you know, to form a class and do a class action lawsuit, they have to send a letter. That's not all that onerous. It's in, you know, in an absolute sense, it is perhaps onerous in the relative sense of we're used to clicking on stuff and indicating our assent or communicating online electronically, especially in this space when we're dealing with video games and all that stuff. But there's nothing that's, you know, that shocks the conscience to make you think that this is going to be something that would just really rip somebody's opportunity away from them to have their grievances heard against Sony. So I come down on the side of Sony on this, saying this is a perfectly legitimate and reasonable thing for them to do in their terms of service to be able to control and constrain the litigation costs that they may incur having to defend class action lawsuits, which are very easy to participate in from the plaintiff side, and there certainly is an incentive for members of the plaintiff's bar to rally a class and go after big bad Sony. So, assuming that the mechanics are okay, setting these terms of service up, I think Sony's fine, and I have no other objection to it.
Hey,
seems
Denise?
Like yes.
Actually, I thought the more interesting piece of this is that Sony is taking advantage of the Supreme Court ruling in the Conception case, which had overturned California's almost flat ban on using arbitration to destroy class action lawsuits. And I find the Conception case confusing. I don't really know exactly what it says, but clearly Sony's made the decision that it means you can use arbitration clauses to destroy class action lawsuits. And I noticed, for example, that Spotify recently did the same thing. They just updated their terms to do that as well. And it seems to me that this is the trend in the future. So as more companies take a look at the Conception case, they look at what their peer companies are doing, I think they're going to make the same decision that Sony and Spotify have done. And I think they're going to be trying to destroy the class actions through these arbitration clauses. So I thought the more interesting piece was how Sony made a decision based on the ambiguous Conception precedent.
Yeah, I understand that courts want to foster arbitration agreements as a way of more efficiently resolving disputes. But it seems to me when you throw in the class action piece, that's a pretty big right that's being waived. And the burden on the plaintiff's lawyers trying to put together a class becomes almost impossible to overcome. You know, they've got to find not just a class representative who was savvy enough to opt out via a written mailed letter, but then all the class members would have to do it too. So it seems to me like something that a court would look at and say, this just seems like too much. It goes too far.
Do you agree? I'm just playing the, if you want to direct this to Eric, that's fine. But my question would be, why is that inherently bad? I'm just playing the devil's advocate. I could come up with some reasons why, but I'm wondering you know, what you would articulate, why that's so bad. Why should it be hard for classes to be assembled? If there truly is a grievance, then it will come together and there will be, you know, a class action, a lawsuit. Otherwise, this seems to be pretty effective in filtering them out, raising the burden higher.
I don't know. I it's very effective in filtering them out, but I think it's a little disingenuous to think that people who might actually, you know, someday down the road have some legitimate basis to sue would, looking back, have been savvy enough to realize that, ooh, when that update came out, I really should have sent in a letter. What do you think, Eric?
Right. So we have, I think, several different dynamics here. We have the dynamic of are class actions a good thing or a bad thing? And then we have the dynamic of user rights versus service provider rights. How do we strike a balance between the freedom of the users and the freedom of the site? And then we have very procedural questions like the enforceability of click-through agreements and the techniques like Sony's using to make people jump through a bunch of hoops if they want to preserve their rights. And so all those conflict together. So if I'm hearing Evan correctly, he's voting class actions are fundamentally questionable. And so anything else along the way is fine if it leads to the outcome of shrinking the number of class actions. But I think if I'm hearing you correctly, Denise, you're focusing more on the procedural piece, which is it makes no sense to make people jump through all these ridiculous hoops if they actually want to preserve the rights. We know all that Sony is doing is making it so that nobody will ever take advantage of that option and will acquiesce to the terms. I have very conflicted norms on this. I am very skeptical about the class action activity I see. On the other hand, I'm also a little bit skeptical about the ways service providers take advantage of defaults and cognitive biases and other tips and tricks to get outcomes that are not really what the consumer intended if they could have negotiated in an open forum.
I think if a court were to come along and say that this method of getting people to agree to arbitration and I use agree with air quotes here, to arbitration and waiver of class action rights, if a court endorses that, it pretty much says that whoever you are, whatever individual capacity you're operating in as you're going around using your PSP or Spotify or whatever, every time there's a bit of legalese thrown at you, you need to retain a lawyer and read through that and find out, you know, what you're waiving expressly. And Ernie, I just don't think that's a practical thing to expect people to do. Do you?
No, I don't. I think it's unreasonable.
So what do we do about this?
Let's ask Siri. Siri, what should we do about this problem with the Sony terms and conditions?
Looks sunny to me.
Looks sunny to her. Like, I'll take that as I think there's no problem.
Thank you, Siri. That's like, probably the most like intelligent response we've had today.
Sounds like Apple is in favor of mandatory adhesion contracts too. Surprise.
Exactly. Why wouldn't they be?
Yeah, Siri might be biased.
Right. Well, Eric, my question to you in connection with this Dunston versus Comscore case that Venkat wrote about and you commented about on your excellent blog, is whether you think courts are getting a bit fed up with all this. It seems like the judge in that case looked past some other more definitive precedent on click-through agreements to say, you know what, this one shouldn't be enforced and I'm not going to enforce it. Do you think that judges are starting to get miffed about all this?
Let's start with the baseline. Most click-through agreements sail through courts, no problem. We have a long list of cases where click-through agreements have been upheld in court easily, not even worth any serious discussion. But we have some outliers, and this might be an outlier. In this case, the parties disagree about what happened, but the one way of interpreting the facts is that the user clicked through the agreement but says he couldn't see that there was an agreement there that he was clicking through because there was some window or a pop-up that obscured the key part. The judge made this ruling on a motion to dismiss. And one way of interpreting the motion to dismiss standard is that the judge just has to believe the plaintiff, if ultimately the plaintiff isn't going to win. The procedural requirements are put the burden on the judge to accept the plaintiff's arguments without question. And that's what this judge did. The judge said, plaintiff said they didn't see the agreement, and therefore they get to survive another day. The plaintiff's ultimately going to have to back up their argument, and they may not be able to, in which case they got a victory, but not really very much, because they're still going to lose. Having said that, I had hoped that the judge would be a little more aggressive, because every plaintiff is always going to argue in every click-through agreement, I didn't see that. I had no idea what was going on. And if all it takes is the bald assertion that the plaintiff didn't see it, then these click-through agreements aren't going to be enforceable on a motion to dismiss. And I think that's going to be very expensive and time-consuming for all the parties involved. So I can't tell if this was a judge just being a stickler about the motion to dismiss standard, if this was a judge who didn't believe the defendant and was willing to cut the plaintiff a little bit of slack, or if this is a judge who really didn't do the gatekeeping that we expect.
Okay, well, thanks for unpacking that for us. It does seem like a strange anomaly in the click-through decisions. I'm interested in whether you got to take a look, Eric, at something we featured in episode 131 as our resource of the week, a little bookmarklet called Toss Amend, which purports to take language in agreements that you encounter online, doctor them up as you would like, change them to read, for example, I don't agree that I'm granting you a non-exclusive worldwide sub-licensable license, but I do agree I enjoy ham sandwiches. And it sends that back to the server and purports to amend the terms of service that you're agreeing to. Do you think that this kind of thing could work and be enforceable and actually empower users?
I did take a look at it. Venkat is actually hoping to write on this subject. I know he's fascinated by it. But I haven't blogged on it. I probably won't. It's a fun little thought experiment. It's like those whistleblower movies from the 70s and 80s, you know, where some activist stands up and the whole union falls behind and says, "We're going to take on the man." And so from that perspective, it's a lot of fun to think about. You know, hey, I could really stick it to the service providers who are cramming these bogus contracts down my throat. No, it doesn't work. Now, the question is, what happens when someone does that? One possibility is that they effectively knock out the contrary provisions of the agreement, at which point then presumably under standard contract law, there's a bunch of gap filler terms that would fill in whatever got knocked out between the two different versions of the contract. Another is the judge says, you know, you tried that, you knew it wasn't going to work, you still went through, we're just going to stick you with the existing contract. So it strikes me that that's much more likely to be the outcome, that judges are going to say, that's a really funny tool, ha ha, sorry, you're still stuck with the contract.
Got it. Well, thank you for the input on that. We all thought it was pretty funny and interesting as well. We've got lots more to talk about. The EFF got some straight answers on the Silk browser. We want to look at that. And also what's going on with Amazon Prime Instant Video. We've got lots about privacy and much, much more coming up after the break. We're here with Professor Eric Goldman and Ernie Svensson and Evan Brown. But before we get to all that, we'd like to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Vast Conference. If you're like most of us, you want to be professional in every aspect of your business. And when you think about it, professionalism begins with those all-important conference calls with clients and colleagues. What makes a conference call professional? A dial-in number you can give out for calls at a moment's notice. Clear connections when you and your call participants dial in. The popping and delays you can get from voice over IP can be embarrassing. And for large calls, the ability to manage call participants online. I want to tell you about a company which has put all this together so you can be professional when it comes to your conference calls, and that is Vast Conference. It's the professional, affordable, and advanced solution that enables you to quickly connect two or more callers on the phone. Many conference calls have 3 to 5 participants, and Vast supports up to 300 callers at once. They give you both a regular dial-in number and a toll-free number, and you use these to set up calls at any time. Vast calls are clear because they use fiber optic lines and high-end teleconferencing equipment, something you don't get from voice over IP. Vast includes a well-designed conference call management interface, which you can access on their website to manage users and calls, and for large calls, question and answer sessions. You can record any call instantly as an MP3 file with no special equipment and access detailed usage tracking and billing codes for internal accounting. Vast also comes with a friendly, enthusiastic customer service team. They call it above and beyond customer service. And the pricing for this professional conference service is low, and it's pay as you go. 2.5 cents per minute for regular toll calls and 6 cents a minute for the 800 number calls. You decide whether to give out the regular call-in number or the toll-free number for each participant and each call. Sign up is fast and easy, and there are no commitments or contracts. You pay only for the calls you host. And Vast is giving our audience an exclusive 2 business calls free up to 300 minutes to give you a chance to try out the service. So go to vastconference.com and sign up for a free account. It's fast and easy. They'll give you a regular toll number and a toll-free number so you can start using your numbers for calls right away. Be sure to use the promo code TWILL when you go, and you'll get your 2 business calls for free. Thank you so much, Vast Conference, for supporting This Week in Law. All right, I want to talk about Amazon because we talked about the Silk browser a couple of episodes ago. They've been monitoring it on Security Now on our network as well. And the problem with Silk, or the concerns with Silk, which is forthcoming on the Amazon Kindle Fire tablet, which should be out next month, is that it gets in the middle of people's web surfing activity. It can, at any rate. The default is for it to enhance the speed of your browsing experience by routing all the traffic through Amazon before you go on to the servers of your destination sites. And there's some obvious privacy concerns about that, with Amazon being the intermediary of all this incoming web traffic from the Kindle Fire browsers. EFF, and specifically Dan Auerbach over there, had a conversation with Amazon about all these concerns. And Amazon has basically allayed most of their fears. They learned that SSL traffic won't be accelerated in this way at all. It will never use cloud acceleration. They learned that the logging involved will be minimal and temporary. And there's no way to associate the logged data with individual Amazon accounts. And they actually found that there would be some privacy benefits from the way this works, because the persistent SPDY connection between you and Amazon is always encrypted. So there's no way for anyone else on the same Wi-Fi network to spy on you. There's still some concerns. Amazon will have a database of user search histories, and it's possible, as we've seen in lots of examples out there, to glean identities from someone's search history. And they'll have this amazing database of collective browsing activity of all the Kindle Fire users. And you can imagine that law enforcement might find that a useful thing to subpoena and glean information from, much like they do with search engines now. So I'll kick it out to the panel. Ernie, are you assured, based on what EFF was able to find out, that the Silk browser, if it's operating in its speed enhanced mode, is going to be safe for folks to use?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about all the technology. I do know what SSL is, and you know, I understand that that's dealing with secure traffic when you log into your bank and so forth. And I'm sure people would be relieved to know that Amazon is not going to track that. What all else they track and how their SPDY technology works, I'm not really sure. But if the EFF has many of its concerns allayed, that's a good sign, because they are pretty tech savvy. But at the same time, I guess, you know, if Amazon can in some way gain some monetary benefit out of tracking user behavior using this technology, I'm sure they will try to do that. That's what companies do.
Excellent point. Eric, do you feel good about this one?
I was glad the EFF asked a question and got to the bottom of some really thorny problems. I would point out two things that aren't really responsive to your question, but are on my mind about this. First is that the browser operations sound really complicated for consumers to understand. I think that browsers keep getting more complicated. They keep doing more things in more ways. And so it's not clear to me that even though the EFF got all those great answers, that consumers will really understand how the browser works and why they would choose one setting over another. And I don't have a good solution for that, but I would point out the problems of browser complexity have been ratcheting up over the years. The other is that this shows that we have certain template assumptions about what a browser is and isn't. And the Silk browser definitely changes that in ways that I think are useful for regulators to consider. I could imagine regulators locking down a bunch of technological assumptions about what a browser does and doesn't do based on browsers circa 1998. And if they'd done that, it would have made it very difficult for the kind of innovation that we're seeing from Amazon. Maybe ultimately we are nervous about that innovation, but the point is when we lock in our assumptions about how the technology operates, we actually handcuff the ability to come up with new and more interesting things. And I think I'm glad that Amazon's trying to navigate the regulatory gauntlet in order to put an offering like this on the market.
Yeah, I'm glad too. Evan, any thoughts on this before we move on to how Amazon is further altering the video entertainment market?
Just a couple of quick comments kind of to echo a number of things that have been said here. I think the big question we all had was how it was going to deal with encrypted traffic. So it's good to see that that won't be run through the server. I think it's also interesting the privacy concern that remains that EFF identifies. One of them is, you know, the search queries being within the URL, which is data that Amazon does indeed retain, or it says that it will retain on all of this. And this whole concept of de-anonymization or re-identification of large data sets. When you have data that is not technically or is not relationally associated with a particular user within a data set, but still being able to figure out who that is, extrapolating that from analysis of a large data set. That's something interesting here, and that risk certainly is still here, even though Amazon tells us that the data is not going to be associated with a particular user. I think that if there's just this enormous multi-terabyte database of just URLs, they could get a pretty granular picture of who's using the service and what for, what they're searching for. So there's definitely a palpable risk there with all this information. On the relative scope, this seems to be a relatively minor or not the preeminent privacy concern that's facing us today. Still the privacy of our locational data is bigger. A bigger problem generally than what is presented by the Silk browser. So those are a couple observations that I have on this new information.
Okay, I wanted to also bring up Amazon Prime Instant Video, which just continues to expand. They've now got, and this probably isn't an exhaustive list, PBS, CBS, Fox, NBC Universal, Sony, Warner Brothers, IFC, Sesame Workshop, and 20th Century Fox all contributing content to their service. And they're compatible with over 300 devices, but only one of them is mobile, and that is the Kindle Fire. And I'm wondering if you guys just feel like engaging in some mad speculation about it, because I have the feeling that the reason for that may be a legal one. What do you think, Evan?
Why it would only be the mobile? Why the Kindle would be the only mobile device?
Yeah, exactly. You can use Amazon Instant Video on set-top boxes and DVD players galore, but only one thing that moves around with you. No phones can use it. No other tablets can use it. It seems pretty counterintuitive based on the success that Amazon's had by making its Kindle app available on all kinds of platforms. Mm-hmm, this service is going to be tied to the Kindle Fire, or, you know, is for the time being at any rate, and the Kindle Fire isn't even on the market yet.
Was it as simple as just the licensing arrangements with the content providers, kind of in the same reason that you can get certain content on YouTube, you know, when you're sitting at your desktop computer, but you can't get it on your iPhone or your iPad or Android device? Is that what you're thinking?
That's what I'm thinking. I smell a legal restriction from the licensors that sort of like they were not happy with what Google TV was enabling people to do and began blocking access from the Google TV box to watching online material. I think here that they don't want this stuff for some reason distributed on mobile devices. I don't know. I'm just speculating. What do you think, Eric?
Certainly a good guess. Given what's happened with Netflix and its negotiation with content providers, it's entirely possible that Amazon was able to say, license us to include it in this new network we're creating that's going to be based on the Kindle Fire, but you don't have to worry about your content leaking out to any other devices. You can go carve up that market some other way. So that certainly sounds like a plausible hypothesis. But, you know, don't rule out the possibility that Amazon's the one that's driving it. In your show notes, you mentioned that, perhaps Amazon's just using this as a way to say, look, the Kindle Fire is really cheap and you get all this bonus content. So ditch Netflix, because for the cost of the Kindle Fire plus Amazon Prime, it's the payback period will be pretty quick, and that's a really good deal for you. So maybe this is just Amazon going bare knuckles against Netflix.
Yeah, it could be that too. All right. Well, I know that we have limited time left with Eric, who has a slew of scintillating academic meetings set up for the rest of the afternoon. So I want to get into some things that you have written about, Eric, before we go ahead and let you go. And the first is this very interesting little wrinkle in the California Reader Privacy Act that was recently signed into law. You think that we were talking about people needing to retain lawyers in contexts where they might not otherwise think to, that this Reader Privacy Act might actually impact bloggers. Can you tell us about that?
So the Reader Privacy Act is a super well-intentioned law. It's designed to make it harder for the government or private litigants to get access to the information about online reading behavior. Just like it's difficult for the government or private litigants to get access to library checkout patterns. And so the idea was pretty simple. It says, hey, we've got this great protection for readers in libraries. Can't we give the same kind of protection online? And at that level, I think terrific. In fact, not only would I like to give the protection for reading behavior online, I'd like to give a whole bunch of other additional protection from the prying eyes of government. The problem is that the statute was drafted in a way that does two things wrong. First, it tries to carve up the universe of information and say, we only give this special protection for book reading practices. Other types of reading practices are not covered by the statute, only books. And in this modern age, I don't really understand what a book is and is not. And the statute tries to define it in a way that I don't think actually answers the question clearly. And then the second thing is that the statute creates a private cause of action for anyone governed by the law who discloses information when they shouldn't have, the plaintiff's privacy bar can rip into them. And because of the ambiguity of the definition of book, it's possible that you could read the law to cover on all different kinds of online content publishers who might not have thought that they were in the book business. So, for example, I made an argument that perhaps bloggers would be qualified as publishing books based on the statutory definition, at which point, if a blogger gets a request for information about its readers and doesn't comply with the statute, let them have at it with the privacy plaintiff's bar. And to me, that strikes me as taking a very well-intentioned statute and actually making a very scary one.
Okay, well, thank you for the update on that. We'll have to have people keep an eye out for when they are given requests for information about the readers of their blogs. Hopefully that would prompt them to consult with an attorney anyway.
Denise, have you ever gotten one of those? Or Evan, have you ever gotten one of those? or Ernie, have you ever got one of those? Have you guys been getting requests for information from the government or private litigants about your blog readers or website readers?
Nope, never.
No.
Never once.
I guess I need to write more controversial stuff.
Well, I haven't, but also I don't allow users to comment on my blog, and that would be one way that it could come up, that someone posts a comment pseudonymously and the government or the private plaintiffs or the private litigants want to find out who that reader was or who that commenter was. And so I don't have comments, so I'm not likely to get that. But I would think that sites that have comments could very well get that. I know TechDirt has. Mike Masnick has posted on that several times.
Yeah, I've read about him. He takes a very proactive stance of not turning over information. I suppose he could be compelled to, but...
The point under the statute is that he would have to navigate through the right hoops before he turned over the information. And if he didn't navigate the hoops properly, then if my reading of the statute is correct, he could be on exposed to private litigation.
Right. Okay, well, thank you for the update on that. And we cannot let you go, Eric, without acknowledging 15 years of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. We're five, and it's 15.
Sorry.
Yeah, we're catching up. You logged into, I assume you didn't attend in person, the Advisory Committee to the Congressional Internet Caucus's event on Section 230 this week. And you've also written recently about sort of an anomalous Alabama case that ignored Section 230. You want to just give us your current rundown on the state of this statute that protects intermediaries like bloggers when people come and comment on their sites?
Right. So the statute says that websites aren't liable for third-party content. And it says a bunch of other things as well. It was enacted in 1996 as part of a much larger set of laws that were in some cases, quite regulatory in nature, and Congress enacted this immunity that created this free zone of activity without liability. And it has become the foundation or the skeleton for the entire user-generated content community. There would be a very different user-generated content environment if we did not have this law. Back in March, you may recall that we had a conference where we celebrated the 15-year anniversary of the statute. And in the Silicon Valley, we talked about the kind of innovation that it created, and we talked about the threats that were being posed to that statute. The conversation in D.C. was quite different. First of all, and this is my inferred perspective, obviously I wasn't there, the level of experience or sophistication with the law was lower than what we had here in Silicon Valley. We have a whole industry that's built up around 47 U.S.C. 230, but in D.C., it's just another law. So we were able to have a much faster start in the conversation, I think, than they were. But the real thing I thought was interesting is that in D.C., a lot of the discussion that was there was the back padding. Hey, great job, dude, type of conversation that people who manufacture legislative sausage engage in. We didn't have any of that at our conference, but at least half of it was the winks and the nods to everyone else in the room. You did a really good job over there. Nice job. Good work.
Wonderful. So how about this Alabama case that decided Section 230 didn't apply?
Well, it didn't talk about Section 230, and that to me is a failing most likely of the lawyers. Although my understanding is that there may be some external intervention into the case to help make sure that if the case goes up on appeal that we get it right. But the basic argument is that by not deleting user comments, we could infer malice for purposes of defamation law, that the site operator, in this case it was a MySpace page, so we don't think of them as a typical site operator, but in this, for kind of reducing it to its minimum, the site operator didn't delete comments, knew those, therefore, that those comments were being published, and therefore we could infer malice against them, to which the starting point is those comments should be irrelevant for any legal purposes based on the statute. And by not connecting the dots, I think the judges missed something big. I'm hoping that the case gets appealed and that on appeal, the court will understand that when we're looking at the MySpace page operator's liability, they're liable for what they said, and we might conclude that what they said was improper. But we can't infer anything else based on what they did with user comments. That's categorically off limits from a legal standpoint.
All right. Well, Ernie and Evan are both in time zones where they have already had lunch, but you are not, Eric. So we're going to go ahead and let you go and grab a bite before your busy afternoon. We really appreciate your being here with us today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. And again, congratulations. I've lost count of the number of times that I've been on Twill, but it's always a pleasure. Love doing it. So once again, thanks for having me.
We love having you too. And we're going to feature at the end of the show your wonderful third quarter post wrapping up everything that has happened in technology law this year. So just to give you the heads up that that's coming while you're off dining. And in the meantime, folks can always go check out Eric's wonderful blog at blog.ericgoldman.org. He's on Google Plus. He's on Twitter, Eric Goldman, both places. Anything else you want to plug before we sign off?
No, but I do want to say thank you, as always, to Evan and Ernie for letting me rub shoulders. Also a pleasure. And thanks very much.
Same here. Enjoyed it.
Yes. Yes. Right on.
Great. Thank you, Eric. We'll let you go.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. So we've got more to discuss besides our show turning five and the Communications Decency Act provision that we so love, Section 230, turning 15. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act is 25. And according to the EFF, is well past its prime. So we want to get into that and talk about whether and how it should be changed. But we're going to thank our final sponsor for the show first, and that is Carbonite Business, which is online backup for your law office. Carbonite Business backs up your computer files automatically and continually and keeps them safely off-site. You can try it free at carbonite.com. And that's just a wonderful way to make sure that all of your files are secure and backed up. They're backed up automatically and continually. They're kept safe. They're kept in a place where they cannot be damaged or harmed. And the prices start at just $229 a year. And when you're talking about the security of the data for your business, that's a really, really reasonable thing to be able to sleep well at night. It only takes about 10 minutes to get started. And you're going to get two bonus months with the offer code TWIL, T-W-I-L. So if you go to carbonite.com, use offer code TWIL, you'll be able to take advantage of that great two-month offer. We thank Carbonite so much for their support. All right, so we've got the Electronic Communications Privacy Act turning 25, and I can't imagine why EFF thinks that it needs a little renovating after that all that time. Can you, Evan?
Well, that would be in the EFF's, that would be their modus operandi to be complaining about it. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, it does seem like when Eric was commenting earlier on how it's difficult to regulate the internet. I think, you know, certainly something that's been around for 25 years is not something that we can expect to be able to adequately control online activities today. It's one of the dangers of enacting legislation and then having it persist. Yeah. Ernie, are you concerned about the changes needed in this act?
Well, I mean, I think any act that is being used to apply to internet conduct that's 25 years old probably deserves a close look. And I know that what the EFF was concerned about is that the act should perhaps be reshaped to provide better protection for cloud storage and for tracking of, you know, geolocation tracking on your cell phone and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, it's definitely something that we should look at. I mean, I don't think it ever envisioned what's going on today, and yet it's going to be applied to things that are going on today. I know we may talk about it later, but that Facebook lawsuit that was brought in Louisiana mm-hmm. is brought under the Electronic Communications Act, and the claim is that, you know, Facebook is doing things it shouldn't do, and, you know, does that act apply to what Facebook? I mean, it was written before Facebook or anything like it was ever even contemplated. So, yeah, we should probably take a look at it.
It was probably written before Mark Zuckerberg was born, I imagine.
Exactly. It's just about right on target, I think. Maybe he was in utero at the time.
Yeah.
Well, for anyone wanting more information about that, the EFF is doing a lot of activism about this. You can go to digitaldueprocess.org and you can read about the internet companies that the EFF has joined with to advocate for reforms to that act. But let's talk about this Louisiana lawsuit, Ernie, the one about Facebook tracking. This is a class action. Nobody has waived their rights to bring it, apparently. Maybe we'll see that urged at some point. But they are objecting to the way that Facebook tracks users' web browsing activity. Have you taken a look at this? And where do you think this is headed?
Yeah, I have taken a look at it, and it's funny, a friend of mine who's a lawyer sent me the link, and I went to Pacer and I downloaded the complaint, and I've been tracking it, and I went on today just to see if anybody had responded to it, and they have not. So it's just sitting there. It's in Baton Rouge, in federal court in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's brought by a law firm that includes a fellow who used to be the Attorney General of Louisiana, for whatever that's worth. And basically what they're saying is that up to September of 2011, Facebook tracked users' wire and electronic communications, including but not limited to portions of their internet browsing history, even when the users were not logged into Facebook. So that seems to be the critical problem they have, is that somehow Facebook was able to track them even after they logged out.
Right, which does seem problematic. Evan, what do you think about this? We've talked about taco suits before as class actions that really shouldn't have been brought. Do you think that this may fall into that category, or there's something more problematic about Facebook's activity?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't put that in this one in the category of a taco suit. And just mm-hmm. to remind ourselves, that was something that it was Nilay Patel that came up with that, right? Where it's just a completely frivolous lawsuit. It had to do with like the Taco Bell, the beef content and the Taco Bell tacos. So it's a lawsuit that has absolutely no meaning, not based on anything really worthy of concern. And I don't think that this falls into that category, because if you think about it, our expectation of privacy when we're using Facebook is that, yeah, Facebook may know what we're doing when we're actually there. And maybe even one might argue that we have a reasonable expectation that Facebook will keep track of us even when we go to other sites, as long as we're logged into Facebook. But if it's tracking us everywhere we go when we're trying to have nothing to do with Facebook, that's something that's very different. And this is a situation that exemplifies very well some of the problems with the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and its age. It shows, you know, why there is some strain in all of this because of the anachronisms, really. The world of computing was much different in 1986, and some of the definitions that the Electronic Communications Privacy Act gives us to work with just don't make any sense at all anymore. It's really truly fitting square pegs into round holes. For example, there are two important terms. One is a remote computing service and an electronic communications service provider. So a remote communications or remote computing service is something, this wacky thing in 1986 nomenclature where a lot of data processing was sent off to be done somewhere else. A little bit different than, you know, the notion of cloud computing or application service providing. So we're just given these weird definitions that are based on mid-1980s technologies that do not contemplate the types of electronic communications, or at least the conveyance of information between a server and a browser and over the web, the kind of things that are the reality now. So there's definitely something that is fundamentally objectionable about this. And it's situations like this where we don't have somewhere in federal law to point and clearly say that this is something that is redressable, you know, under this statute. At best we can say it rouses some sense of inequity in us, and so we have to strain a little bit to actually articulate how it does violate the law. So it's very fitting that we're talking about this in the context of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And we could very well be talking about how the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act as well, you know, another 1980s relic amended several times, you know, with the Patriot Act and stuff, but how it is also showing its age as well when it comes to notions of unauthorized access and you know, all this, the things that you can do now with computers and network systems that you could not do and, you know, just didn't have any practical applications in the mid-1980s.
Well, okay, since we're on the topic of Facebook, that class action is pending down where Ernie lives. Up in your neck of the woods, we don't have a class action, but we have the dispute between Timelines and Facebook over the use of the word Timelines as we await Facebook's rolling out of that service to its general user base. Timelines has come out and explained the underpinnings of its trademark suit against Facebook, so we at least have some more context for that. Have you taken a look at that, Evan, and do you think that all of this is delaying the release of the Timeline service?
Well, you know, it certainly would help explain why the Facebook Timeline service is being delayed. I don't think anybody knows for sure except people within Facebook as to whether this does affect it. Facebook has plenty of other explanations as to why it's delaying the rollout of all this. But this explanation that Timelines gives, it's on the All Facebook blog. They copied it from a blog post that Timelines, the company, the Chicago company here, posted. And you can tell this was written in close collaboration with their legal counsel, which, I remind you, Denise, it's your old law firm who's representing Timelines in this, so they're doing a good thing. Very well written, a lot of smart people there. You know, they spell out and say it very clearly how unfair this is, that Facebook is being so renegade and taking over this. But they also point out a little bit of hypocrisy on Facebook's part about how it has been so aggressive in trying to gain exclusive or exercise exclusive rights in word like, you know, face and book and wall, like and things like that. So it's good to see a principled exposition of it here. And to be honest with you, I think it makes a lot of sense. I would not be surprised if Facebook, when it was deciding what to call this feature of the platform, that it did not think in terms of trademark protection. You know, it doesn't. Facebook, by all intention or by all indications, does not intend to, you know, really launch the timeline feature as a product. It's just a feature. It's how you would describe this thing. But Facebook, being such a behemoth and occupying such a space in people's online, you know, taking up such a big chunk of people's online time, there, it's inevitable that the association that Facebook would make between this word that it chooses and this feature is going to be what is indelibly, the connection that's going to be indelibly made in people's minds. I suppose it didn't help Facebook either to take away facebook.com/timelines as the page for this company. That didn't help either. So I really hope to see something meaningful happen and give Facebook a dose of reality on its trademark overreaching on this.
All right. Well, thanks for the update there. We'll stay tuned, and I'm looking forward to being able to use Timelines at some point and see if maybe there's another class action privacy lawsuit in the offing that that might be coming Facebook's way. We have a great tip of the week for you from our friend Jonathan Bailey at Plagiarism Today. He wrote a post called 5 Copyright Wastes of Time, where he points out that everyone's looking how best to maximize the benefit they get from their work. But there are some copyright ideas that just don't do anything, or in extreme cases, actually do more harm than good. And so this is actually 5 tips of things that you should not do in efforts to protect your copyright. First being badges and buttons everywhere. He thinks this is just too much, and they're just a means to generate links back to the companies. They don't really give you much notice or have any legal impact. He says the better approach is to make sure your copyright notice is in check and that it has all of the required elements. Then this is a real pet peeve for me. Number 2, no right-clicked and no select text scripts. So I don't know, you've probably experienced going to a site where you want to copy and paste some text and you find out you can't do that because they're running a script that keeps you from doing that. Jonathan has tried out something called Tint, which has that feature built into it. It also allows you, if you're not using the anti-copy-paste function to track when your work has been copied and pasted. And he thinks that that is a far more effective way of identifying whether there's a use that you object to and want to do something about. Self-written licenses, he says, are right out the door. And I'd have to agree, it's a really bad idea to try and write your own license. Creative Commons is a great option if you're looking for a license, or of course, lawyers in general will help you find out exactly how to write a license to the works in the way that you want it handled. Number four, fake copyright registration services. He warns of these being out there. There are some great reputable ones out there. There are a slew of others with insane pricing schemes and scare tactic marketing strategies. So if you're looking to register your copyrights, be careful about that. And then EXIF data. Theoretically, this should be a great idea. It would embed copyright information in the actual work itself electronically, but it's stripped out almost everywhere it's uploaded. So he says it just doesn't work, and don't rely on that. Instead, look at watermarking with either a visible or invisible watermark if you're trying to put some sort of notice digitally on a photo file itself. So great tips from Jonathan. We appreciate those. And then I mentioned over at Eric's blog, he has been the busiest blogger here in the third quarter of 2011. He has a 5-part series on literally everything that has happened in technology law year to date. And it's really wonderful. If you're looking to get up to speed or looking for a reference to something that you know has happened this year and you just can't remember what the outcome was, Eric has got it all for you, and he's aggregated it all at one post. It's called Q3 2011 Quick Links. And I'll go ahead and put that in our links to our discussion points for this episode, which are at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/134. You can find it there, along with links to everything else we have talked about today. There was one other little scam thing, since one of Jonathan's tips highlighted a scam that I wanted to just mention, so that it's just interesting to note that it happened. Over in France, we've talked about how they are one of the countries with a 3 strikes infringement policy, where people can get booted off their ISP when they get 3 notices that they have been engaged in infringing practices. So some company there has, or I don't know if it's a company, a fraudulent scheme has put together false 3 strikes notices. And has been sending it out to people. This is from Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt. He spotted this. And what they do is they require people to either text or dial a phone number that then charges them an exorbitant amount. That's the scam, as they're getting money out of people as they're trying to respond to this notice from the French organization Hadopi, if I'm pronouncing that right, which is in charge of sending out these notices. So it's just kind of a lesson that if something can be scammed, it will. And so this is going on in France. Evan, any thoughts on that one?
Well, it's not to, no, it comes as no surprise. And, you know, anytime you're going to have the opportunity to scare someone, people will seize upon that opportunity and do it. I mean, I'm not a fan of the 3 strikes policy. I think that it, and we've talked about this ad nauseum on the show about how, mm-hmm. you know, there are due process concerns with all this. I would caution us for thinking that it being susceptible to scamming, as I would caution us against using that too strongly as an argument against the 3 strikes policy. Because there are plenty of other more legitimate due process sure. kind of arguments to make against that, because you can get scammed in all kinds of legitimate things like Social Security, Medicare, all kinds of stuff that nobody's going to think it depends on if you're a Republican running for president. So just got way too complicated. Yeah, there are plenty of other things to argue against 3 strikes on besides this.
Right. Well, Ernie, at least you always have Siri there. You can always run something by her. Find out if it's a scam.
She is my paralegal.
There you go.
Digital paralegal. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and call this the end of episode 134 of This Week in Law, our fifth anniversary episode. We're so grateful to all of you for joining us here on the TWiT Network for the last 5 years. It's been a thrill and a pleasure to be able to bring this to you. We record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. You can tune in at twit.tv to watch us there. Or, of course, you can find our shows and all our back episodes at twit.tv/twill. And of course, you can subscribe in iTunes and go to our YouTube page, any number of ways to tune into the show and enjoy this or any of the prior episodes if you're so inclined. And between the shows, you can reach me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. I love hearing from you, getting questions and comments on the things we've discussed and getting ideas for things to discuss in future shows. So definitely hit me up there. And you can hit Evan Brown up at his blog, internetcases.com.
Yes,
there he is. And Evan, you've been such a huge part of these 5 years. I just can't thank you enough for joining us and giving us all your insights, not just this show, but throughout almost the entire history of the show. So thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. It's been my pleasure. And thanks for having me around.
Absolutely. And you can find Evan on Twitter at Internet Cases there. Wonderful insights both on his blog and wonderful, not just tech law related things, but life related things coming through your Twitter stream that I always enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Ernie, you've been there with us along the way almost all the time too, and from the very first show. So thank you so much for coming back with us today.
Anytime. It's been a pleasure and I enjoyed it very much. Evan, thank you for your insights and for your good sportsmanship. I'll be rooting for the Bears this week.
Oh, right on. Right on. Thanks.
Ernie, your great blog at ErnieTheAttorney.net looks like it got a recent makeover. It's looking very pretty these days.
Yes.
Dusted off and shined up.
Yep, all new and improved.
Love it. And of course, Ernie's also on Twitter. He's ErnieAttorney there with many more humorous asides and life insights as well. And over on the Google Plus as well, Ernie Svensson there, so go ahead and find Ernie. He's well worth seeking out. And thank you all so much for joining us on this episode of This Week in Law. We'll see you next week. Take care.